The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
They show you how to make bombs on the internet, if you know where to look. What to buy, where to buy it from, how to fit the whole thing together. There are even videos. Men in balaclavas with screwdrivers, soldering wires on tidy workbenches in breeze block garages. They don't really tell you about the risks, but the risks stand to reason. Be careful with explosives. That doesn't need to be spelled out to anyone, surely. No one needs to say don't try this at home, do they? There are instructions for big bombs, small bombs, nail bombs, chemical bombs, all the bombs you could ever want to make. Small to medium was the right choice here. Stable enough to carry around, powerful enough to kill. In the end, the easiest thing to do was go to one of the websites that does all the work for you. Custom make the bomb to your specifications, deliver it, even help you place the thing if that's what you need. This particular company had received very good reviews. They even offered a money-back guarantee if the bomb failed to go off. They're called Boom or Bust.
And that is the beginning of a new book from the voice you've just been listening to, Richard Osman. The book is called The Impossible Fortune, and Richard is with me now. Good morning and welcome.
Hey, Pat, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I often read my own work. It's funny reading your own work, because all you want to do is edit it.
Again.
You just want to go, hold on a minute, maybe if I just... Yeah. You must all, anyone who's ever writing at home, always read it out loud, because then you work out how bad it is.
Now, the last time we spoke, I think, was down the line, so we didn't get to meet face-to-face at the time of the publication of the first book about the Thursday Murder Club. And how many books since?
Yes, 12 million, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a few, isn't it?
That's quite a few.
Yeah.
Is this a kind of an accidental career for you as a literary celebrity?
No, my other career was the accidental career. It's the truth. I'd always been a writer. I'd always been a journalist in my teens. You know, I'd written for music magazines. I'd written sitcoms and animations and things like that. And then I sort of weirdly became a producer when one of my writing things failed. And I realized that being a producer was easier than writing. And then I really accidentally became a television presenter, which wasn't part of my life's plan at all. And it was only in my late 40s I thought, writing is the thing that you do. Blank pieces of paper is the thing that you do. And so I'd started so many novels over the years. I thought, no, now, come on, let's do this properly. So this was always the career, and everything else is the weird cul-de-sac.
Mm. And yet, I was trying to find out about your formation, shall we say, from an early age. You were actually broadcasting as a schoolboy.
I sort of was, yeah. They had in Sussex, Radio Sussex, they had like an access show called Turn It Up. And it was, you know, indie music and bands and gig reviews and music. And every Sunday evening it would be on, and you'd go along as a volunteer. So, yeah, I was presenting a radio show when I was kind of 15, 16. And that course, because I didn't know anyone in broadcasting, nothing like that. And Joe Wiley came from that, who's now a big name in the UK. Clive Myrie, who hosts Mastermind, he came through that as well. I went through it. So what an amazing thing to have that the BBC gave all of us this experience that we have. And I've always loved doing radio.
Now, were you bitten by, if you like, the showbiz bug at that point?
I love watching television. I love listening to the radio. I like being in the conversation. That's what I like. I'm sort of obsessed with TV and radio and fame and all that. I've always found that fascinating. And I was always one of those people who'd watch things or listen to things and look at the credits and see who did what and see what the jobs were and imagine what must it be like to be the vision mixer on Top of the Pops? This must be the most incredible thing. And so, yeah, I think in my head it always been a fantasy to be involved from a boy from a low-income household in a small town in the middle of nowhere. The idea that at some point you could be there in the middle of show business, I think, was exciting.
Now, music is obviously a preoccupation of yours as well. Mm-hmm. Were you a musician of any substance?
No, my brother is the musician in the family. I've got no skills like, you know, if people can learn a musical instrument or learn a language or something, I'm in awe of them. That sort of thing I can't do at all. I can put a word in front of the next word. That's about all I can do. But my brother was and still is a musician. He was a bassist. And so I let him get on with that, and I got on with whatever it was I was getting on with.
Now, from the age of 9, your mother raised you as a single parent.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much influence she has had on you and how that has informed most of your activities and ambition.
I think the best thing, my mum was a reception school teacher eventually, that's what she ended
up. But she had to train when she needs most.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think the thing she understood most of all is that myself and my brother, I loved watching TV and my brother liked playing his bass guitar, and we didn't need to do anything else. We didn't need to be sort of improved. We didn't need to really do our homework. We didn't, you know, so she understood that so long as we were interested in what we were doing, so long as we cared, not to push us in various kind of improving directions. I think she understood that the two of us were self-starters and that it's probably better to let us have our obsession. So she left us alone in that regard.
Now, she did help you to self-improve by helping you to get to Cambridge for politics and sociology.
Yeah, politics and sociology. I was, that again wasn't really in the stars. I was at a school where people hadn't really done that. I wanted to go to Manchester to do, because that was the time of, you know, the Stone Roses and the Happy Mondays, and they had a course in American Studies, which is still, if I was to do a degree now, it would be American Studies, but, you know, despite what's happening to America.
That would be a rapidly evolving course, I suspect.
Well, I was going to say, every single thing I learned has been proved wrong in the last 7 or 8 years. You think, oh, okay, all those norms have absolutely disappeared. Yeah, no, so I went, I had an interview up there, and you go up there, and it's like, it was like Harry Potter world. It's like nothing I'd ever seen before. And, you know, I remember going up there, I didn't have a suit, because I just didn't have a suit, and everyone was wearing suits for the interviews. And
I suspect at 6'7", it's hard to buy.
It's hard to find
a suit.
Yeah, exactly. I was probably only 6'5" then, but even so. I think I could have shrunk away from it, but actually I just thought, well, someone's going to go here. So why not me? Which is what I did.
Often people drop out when they don't come from, if you like, the appropriate background. Yeah. They drop out not because they can't handle the academics, but they can't live up to the social life of places like Oxford and Cambridge.
Yeah, and I can absolutely see that. What did I think about it? I thought, well, I've always been very good at carrying a chip on my shoulder. Okay, so that's one of my special skills. And I did think when I go there, I thought at least I'll kind of see the iniquity of the place and the unfairness of it. And actually, I went there, and so many of the posh kids were so nice and talented. And
surprise, surprise.
That really annoyed me. But there it is. And lots of them are still my friends to this day. No, I think, again, because I'm a talker and a writer, I found my place. I found something that I could do. You know, I could make people laugh. So I sort of found, I never, ever, ever once questioned the fact that I should be there. I definitely felt lesser than those people because they lived their lives in a way that I didn't quite understand. Like, their parents would come out and take them out for lunch at a restaurant. I'd be like, so I'm so sorry. We went to like a carvery once a year on my nan's birthday, but you go out to your parents have come out and taken you to a restaurant. This is like a world, and they'd go to each other's houses over the summer. And you go, what do you mean you're going to stay at someone's house? I mean, you wouldn't get many people in my house, and there'd be like whole groups of them. So I definitely felt inferior. Definitely felt inferior, but at the same time, I learned a huge amount about the world, how it fits together.
And did they embrace you, by the way? Did they invite you to their summers? No.
No, there was the odd sort of, you know, that group sticks together. That's how they endure, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there lots of people knew each other from various schools, and then they'd, you know, played sport against each other over the years, I realise in retrospect. So there'd be the odd person who could make the leap from my bit of Cambridge to the posh bit of Cambridge, but not many. And even now, actually, when I think about the people I know who are from there, there's one very posh group who I am not in touch with, and there's my gang who
are the posh group ruling the world.
Do you know what? They're sort of not anymore, is the truth, because back in those days, you could rule the world without ever having learned how to code, and so they didn't have to have any skills at all. And now there's a different group of people who are running the world, and I think
job in the city with dad.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, a lot of them did. You know, they went into consulting. You think consulting what? I wouldn't consult you on what to have for dinner.
They already know absolutely nothing, and yet they are consultants.
Yeah, and now they're going to charge you to tell you what they don't know. I find it amazing. I've always honestly, the thing that's always saved me in life is give me a blank piece of paper, and I'll make some.
So what beckoned after Cambridge?
Well, I didn't know really. So that was back in the day where, you know, my whole university education was paid for, and, you know, I had full grant all the way through. So I came up there with no debt at all, moved to London because you still got housing benefit. And I saw an advert in the newspaper. I was just about to do an interview for a telly sales job. And I saw an advert in the newspaper saying, computer games television program looking for researchers. And I had just written about computer games for a golf magazine. The weird things, the weird bits of serendipity that get us where we're going. I thought, well, I've just written this thing about computer games, so I'll go along and do that interview. And so I go in there, and the woman interviewing me, it was a terrible reverse snob, and she said, how can you make a television program for someone on a housing estate in Basildon? And I said, well, I grew up on a housing estate in Billericay, which is 5 miles down the road. I think I'll be fine. And so I got that job done. And went in there, and I realized that I'm amongst a group of people who'd never watched TV, you know, who were slumming it, as you know, they got where they were because of family and stuff. And there were three or four of us there who loved TV and watched TV. And so I found that career. I thought, well, I've been training for this all my life. And so I was able to hit the ground running and come up with ideas.
So everything evolved from there, writing for television, then producing for television, ultimately leaping over the footlights and being on television.
That was the weird thing. And I'd had a long career. You know, I love coming up with TV shows because I used to love watching them, and I love coming up with formats. I'd done that for years and years and years. And quite often when you sell a TV show, you'll play it through for the channel. Sure. You know how that goes. And so we had this idea, Pointless, and had two hosts. And so I always make sure that you get producers playing the presenters when you pitch it to a channel, because they know what's wrong with the show. They know what's good with the show. Mm. They can, you know, accentuate the positive. And so two of us producers went in and did it. I played the Richard Osman role. BBC liked the show, wanted to buy it. They had the idea of Alexander Armstrong doing his role. And they said, we need someone like Richard to do the Richard role. And some bright spark at the BBC said, well, why don't we ask Richard? Because he's very much like Richard.
And you already knew Alexander?
Yes, sort of. Again, funnily enough, he is of the Cambridge set. He was one of the posh ones, but actually Xander can travel in any carriage he wants in life. He's very good with everybody. So someone came up to my desk and said, the BBC said, would you be interested in doing it? I thought, well, I mean, it's only going to be one series because most things fail. Story to tell the grandchildren. Why not? Something I've never done before. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And, you know, 2,000 shows later, I was still there.
And if you pardon the pun, the rest is history.
The rest, yes.
And there's a reason for that pun, which we'll come to in a little while. So then you discovered the price of fame, I suppose. 6'7", walking down the street, being on telly.
Yeah.
You're hard to miss.
I am hard to miss. I think about it sometimes. Weirdly, for whatever reason, I think about it today as I was walking through the airport at Heathrow on my way over here. And I was feeling self-conscious, and I always feel self-conscious because, as you say, I'm 6'7", people can see me. But I was thinking, yeah, but because I'm 6'7", I always felt self-conscious anyway. If I was walking through Heathrow and people didn't know who I was, I'd still be feeling self-conscious because they'd be seeing, wow, my God, look at that guy. He's so tall. So actually, there's a bit of me that thinks, well, I'm self-conscious, but at least...
But now they're saying, there's the guy off the telly.
Yeah.
Not the guy who's huge.
And people, by and large, are so lovely to me that actually it is... So I don't mind it quite so much because I think I've always had it. I think people have always stared at me and have always sort of picked me out in a crowd.
Now, talk to me about the genesis of the series, The Thursday Murder Club. Mm. You know, where did the germ of the idea come from once you decided, I've got to do this writing bit seriously?
Yeah, as I say, I'd started loads and loads of books. And I'd started one about 3 or 4 years beforehand about a guy whose job was incredibly boring, worked in the middle of government for logistics, like paper clips and photocopies and stuff like that. That was his job. But his job was so boring that everyone assumed that he must be a spy and that this is a cover story. But he wasn't. He was logistics. But anyway, so I had that. So I had this idea of like a spy type thing. And I was down at, my mum lives in a retirement village down in Sussex. And I would go there, and it's a very beautiful place, you know, rolling fields and blue skies and birdsong. And I thought, oh my God, this would be an amazing place for a murder. You know, my mum's a big Christie fan, so am I. And so I'd say to my mum, wouldn't this be an incredible place for a murder? She said, yeah, oh God, I've thought about that. And then you talk to everyone who lived there, everyone's over 70, and the life stories they'd had, the things that they'd done in their careers, and the wit with which they presented those things, and the time of the morning they started drinking, I just thought, well, this is an amazing group of people, and if there were a murder here, then I bet you lot would solve it. And there, you know, the Thursday Murder Club is born. There was a notice board up outside the restaurant, which is Tuesday Nat and Knitter, Wednesday French conversation class, and the phrase Thursday Murder Club came into my head, and I just thought, oh yeah, this feels like, because I knew immediately who the characters were going to be. I knew what the setting was. I knew I had this whole world of people who were slightly invisible but very wise, which is amazing for a group of detectives. So I just thought, well, at some point you're going to write your first novel. Let's make it this one.
Now, the movie many of us have seen with a really stellar cast.
Yeah.
But that movie was optioned and began to be created long before we actually got to see it.
Yeah, before the first book was even published, which was, you know, because once I had written the book and, you know, the publishers had bought it, a bit of me is still thinking, yeah, but are they buying it because of my name and stuff like that? And we'd sold it in other countries and I knew they didn't know who I was. But then when the film and TV rights went out and Steven Spielberg's company came straight in and said, we love this story, and he didn't know who I was, that was the thing that really gave me confidence that, oh, okay, these characters work and this story works and this idea works. But that was, so 2020, he would have done that. We'd had COVID, of course. Then we had the SAG-AFTRA strikes out in LA. And you have just how long it takes to make a movie.
Sure.
And then the stars have to align in terms of Helen Mirren's got to be around at the same time as Ben Kingsley and Pierce Brosnan. And so, yeah, it was 5 years later. But I got a lot of mileage out of Spielberg buying it for 5 years before that. So
had nothing to do with the movie. I mean, didn't write the screenplay or anything like that.
I left it in their hands because, honestly, the thing I love doing is writing the books. And writing a movie and being in the movie business is less fun than being in the book business.
The problem may be that, you know, having seen the movie, Elizabeth, to me, is Helen Mirren.
Mm.
You know, and Ron is Pierce Brosnan. So, you know, when you're writing the next one, I mean, Will, now that you've seen the movie, you've probably seen it long since, I've only seen it recently, will you be imagining your characters rather differently?
The Impossible Fortune was written after I'd seen it, or certainly after I'd been down to set. No, because this is going to sound terrible. These characters are incredibly real to me. So for me, I'm watching famous people sort of playing my characters in a reconstruction.
So you can watch the movie as a spectator.
Oh, 100%. I make one small reference to the movie in the book. Ron and Ibrahim are having a conversation in a scene, and I get them talking about who their favorite James Bond is.
Okay.
And Ron's favorite James Bond is Pierce Brosnan.
Of course.
But that's my only nod.
That's a nice little in-joke for those who
I told Pierce that, and he was delighted.
Now, we only heard you reading the beginning of, the very beginning, the first page of The Current. So how much do you want to tell us about the plot of The Impossible Fortune? Because it's very current in terms of crypto and all that sort of stuff.
It is. People who've read the series will know at the end of the fourth book, Elizabeth goes through a big life change and she'd had a year sort of shut away. So I think, okay, How do I get everyone back up and running again? And this is how ideas work. I never know what the plot's going to be, but I just had the idea of someone sitting next to Elizabeth on a bench saying, "Somebody's trying to kill me. Can you help?" That was that's all I had at the beginning. So I thought, okay, I'll sit around the bench and I'll get this person. I don't know who he is, and they can chat. Yeah, and in the end, it's a guy who is in a world called cold storage. Is this a concept that you've heard of? I hadn't heard of it before.
No.
Which is, so hundreds of years ago, if you had a load of doubloons or treasure, you'd bury it in a hole in the ground, right?
Sure, yeah.
That's what you would do.
Treasure Island, all that.
Treasure Island. But we've all known in the 20th century that what you actually do now is you hide everything on computers. You know, that's the safest place for everything. You know, we lock all of our secrets away. It's all kind of binary. It's all digits, and it's all in some bank account in Switzerland. That's where we hide our money. And then people realized 20 years ago that actually that is not safe at all. That hackers can steal whatever you've got, Bitcoin, whatever it is, hackers can do it. So all the big major criminals now, do you know what they do with their money and their secrets? They bury it in a hole in the ground because it's offline. No one can touch it. It's called cold storage. It's like you keep something where there's no computer can ever touch it. So I got the guy who is being threatened with being killed. He runs a big cold storage facility, which is essentially a big hole in the ground where bad people bury bad things. And I just thought that's a fun world for me to get involved with and for the Thursday Murder Club to get involved with.
I presume there will be more iterations of the Thursday Murder Club.
I'm just doing another one in my other series, We Solve Murders, at the moment. That's the thing I'm writing. And then I'll be back onto another one of these. So, yeah, they'll be coming for a good few years to come.
What do you think? I mean, you don't analyze things that work too closely in case you break them in some way. But What do you think is the appeal? I mean, we have Murders in the Bill, only Murders in the Building on telly. We have, I think there's another telly called the Marlowe Murder Club.
Yes, yeah.
And of course, we have Midsummer Murders.
Yeah.
It's sort of genteel murders, really.
Yeah, well, we love murders. My thing is always, when people come and talk to me about writing books, the main question people always ask is, how do you come up with plots, right? That's the main question people ask. And it's the wrong question. Because there's a million plots. We all know, walk around your neighbourhood. There's a million plots. Just look at your family at Christmas. Just look around that table. There are a million petty jealousies and arguments and things like that. Character is the thing. Character is the thing we love. And crime fiction, there's a really simple equation, which is, right, I'm going to kill someone at the beginning, and at the end, it's going to look impossible, but at the end, it's going to be solved.
Classic Agatha.
There will be a solution. But in between, you can do anything you want. You go on any journey you want. You can tell any story you want about your own country, about your own culture, about what's happening in the world. And if you want to spend time with the characters, that's when you have a book that people want to read. And that is the key. Character, character, character.
In the same way as we still watch reruns of Poirot, for example, I mean, the setting we find ourselves in the company of the characters of the Thursday Murder Club is nice.
Yeah, I think so. And I love those four characters. It's so funny because young people, when they talk to me about the book, always say, oh, thank you for making older characters heroes. And older people, when they talk to me about the book, always say, thank you for not making the older characters heroes. Thank you for showing us as flawed and mischievous and naughty and, you know, as I say, drinking too early and all of those things. Thank you for showing us as human. So, yeah, I think it's everyone is on the side of an underdog. And in our culture, the older you get, the more of an underdog you are, because our culture is obsessed with 25-year-old influences, right?
And I often wonder when there are those of a particular age and circumstance living in a nursing home and they're reading your book and, nurse, why isn't it not like that here?
Exactly. Why has no one been murdered?
Yeah.
I know it is.
Why isn't the food better?
It has become. Yeah. And this is not a nursing home, though. This is a retirement.
It's a retirement.
This is,
home,
this is pre-nursing home, really. But it is definitively that thing of you are suddenly living with people you wouldn't ordinarily be living with. And we go all the way back to me being at Cambridge and I'm with people that I had never mixed with and they had never mixed with someone like me. I get that here. We've got middle class characters, working class characters, and that mix of people and the abandon they have at that stage in your life, I think is one of the things that makes the book really resonate.
It's extraordinary. In a writer's case, nothing is ever wasted. No experience, no glimpse of anything is ever wasted.
I know. My wife, whenever she reads the new book, she goes, oh, that was that, wasn't it? That was that. Literally, you started writing that the day after we did that. I go, yeah, I'm afraid I did.
Hugely entertaining read. The Impossible Fortune, it is called. It's the latest in the Thursday Murder Club series. It's available absolutely everywhere. And Richard, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
It is such a pleasure to finally meet you in person. Thank you so much, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.